Part two. Let's just bring them on. Samira and Mark. And if there's anybody here who has any objections, thank you so much. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So in this half, we're going to be taking a bit of a deeper dive into A Hard Day's Night. Obviously, Mark's here, so that's going to help things, and Samira as well. So I think, should we start with kind of the origins of the movie, which kind of go back to 1963?
Yes, what do you want to say? What do you want to ask?
I want to ask you to talk your heart out, Mark.
Well, I think one of the amazing things about A Hard Day's Night is that this very British film, with these very British guys set ostensibly Liverpool and London, but you can't really tell, but filmed in London primarily, this very, very English, archetypal English film, is essentially American in creation. The film company United Artists are American, the producer Walter Shenson is American, and the director Richard Lester is American. So it's in American hands creatively, and yet it's so English. And it really came about in October 63 when, actually a little earlier than that, United Artists had a music division in London, and a man there called Noel Rogers felt that they could get the publishing on some Beatles songs if they find a vehicle, like a film vehicle, for them to appear in. He put it forward, eventually it went to Dick James and Brian Epstein, and the idea was, you know, your boys will make a film, we will get the publishing, but, you know, you can make a film, and we'll distribute it. And they brought in, they wanted to bring in Alan Owen, and that was absolutely perfect for the Beatles, because Brian Epstein, this is actually around, wrote a letter to Alan Owen in September 63 saying, if we ever make a film, we would like you to write it. Because he wasn't a pop writer by any means. He wrote gritty drama. He'd written a play called No Trams of Lime Street. And they liked this so much. The Beatles watched this before they were Beatles in 1959-60 on television and thought, this is the man who we would like to write for us. And Richard Lester knew him. They'd worked together already. So it all just fell into place beautifully. But the headline of that is that this very English film was American in origin, and United Artists were the first Americans to get the Beatles. And that was because they were a very progressive company and they had a base in London. They weren't in New York. They were in New York, but they weren't operating this film from New York. It was a London idea. But they became the first Americans to really get the Beatles. And that is all very important. One other thing, just very quickly, in case we don't come back to it. There's a quote that John Lennon gave to Melody Maker newspaper in June 63 saying, we've had opportunities to be in films and we turned them down because they're not the kind of films we want to be in. And that tells you absolutely everything you need to know about the Beatles, in that in life you might get, if you're lucky, you might get the offer to be in a film. And a lot of people will grab that offer because it might be the only one they ever have. And it might not be a very good film, but I want to be in a film, so I'm going to do it. The Beatles had the bravery to turn down things, even if ultimately they would never have made a film. They did not want to be in the wrong film. And they turned down 5 film opportunities before saying yes to this one. And their sense of what to say yes to and what to say no to is unparalleled and brave, and that is the Beatles.
Really interesting. I don't know if you already said this, Mark, but I was interested that when Paul McCartney published the lyrics, they found the draft of a bit of a play that he and John wrote together, the Alan Owen one, and just that idea of kitchen sink drama was something that they were so aware of. And what's really interesting about watching this film is, despite what's been discussed about, you know, the schoolgirl moment, I think they're technically sixth formers, so it's fine. But also, that unlike a lot of films of this era, it doesn't actually have the kind of the sexualized content that's really dated it. They're childlike, but they're not children. And I think that's, again, it's part of the uncanny combination of the production team, the director, the writer, and the four of them, that it doesn't date because there is nothing to date in it. It just captures them of the moment and yet timeless.
Well, it's the cheekiness, isn't it? We touched on this part one, but we were saying about the monkeys. I mean, it's clear, especially the scene where they're suddenly, surreally running outside the train, which I think that was the Beatles' idea as well, wasn't it, on that scene? Or
I don't know if it was their idea. I'm not actually sure. But Richard Lester loves surrealism.
Yeah.
And he wanted to inject something into the film quite early on that would just take you aback, because it obviously couldn't be done in real life. But it wasn't explained either. He had their great... He was empathetic with them in the fact that he didn't need to explain anything. The Beatles never explained anything, and they just did it. And you would have to think about it, and that's what that scene is.
There's one thing related to, you know, the old man, and they say, or Dringo says, I bet you're sorry you won. It struck me watching that scene now, and also there's a similar scene in Billy Liar, which is a film I think has a lot of parallels with John Schlesinger's film, when... Billy and his friend are running down and mucking around in front of a war memorial. And I think if the equivalent of the Beatles were making A Hard Day's Night now, there would be moral outrage in the Daily Mail that they had said anything negative about the war. I think, weirdly, there was less sensitivity around some of that.
There was no sensitivity, really. People just got on with their daily lives. There wasn't any of today's filtering that goes on. You could more or less say and get away with anything. I mean, there's a bit in the film where Paul says to, I think it's, is it Normal Shake? He says, anyway, if you've lost him, I'll cripple you, he says.
Yeah,
and it's just, it doesn't matter. It really is not anything to get upset about. But these days, it might seem inflammatory, but it wasn't then.
Can I talk a bit about just the, just around stuff? I'm really interested in the British Sync social realism films that were being made around there, because by making this in black and white, obviously when colour was being used more and more, you're kind of making an association. And yet it doesn't in any way, like it's a nameless city. You know, we know where the locations were now because people like Mark have lovingly, you know, gone and traced them and you can visit them. But it's not tied to, you know, it's not tied to Liverpool exactly. And there's this... Well, the thing about Billy Liar is... So there's a couple of things on my mind. Like the thing with the milk at the beginning. If you think about Billy Liar, there's a whole thing about, is he going to get on a train to London at the end? And there's a big sequence where he uses going off to get a bottle of milk for Julie Christie as a kind of big thing, won't he? And I couldn't help wondering if at some level Richard Lester was referencing some of these things. There's also, you know, the scattering of the photographs at the end. There's a whole thing through Billy Liar of him trying to dispose of these calendars that he's ripping up and throwing into a kind of old quarry or trying to flush down the toilet. And just that sense of him being constantly on the run. And that was the other thing when I come back to the idea that this film, Hard Day's Night, hasn't dated. In Billy Liar, he's sex mad, as I think John Lennon says of Wilfred Bramble in A Hard Day's Night.
Yes.
But, and all the women are slightly, they're all caricatures in a certain way. You know, there's the frigid one, there's the sexy one that he just wants to have sex with, and then there's the dream girl. And in this film, there's none of that treatment of women. The women in, I mean, is Miss World in it, or Miss UK?
One of the beauties backstage.
One of the beauty queens
was
is backstage.
Miss World, yeah.
But they're all there sort of almost as like little cameos to sort of touch the Beatles. Like Derek Nimmo's there almost for that reason.
Hmm.
So I was really struck by how the films that were trying to play with the angry young man are often the ones that date. And this film, when they're not angry at all, is the one that endures. I find that really interesting.
Yeah, it was very important to Richard Lester. He knew that they couldn't have love interests in this film because it would have got too complicated. So they're quite clearly, it's very cleverly done, because even though they're not womanizing and they don't have anyone attached to them in the film, they're quite clearly interested in the opposite sex, and the opposite sex is interested in them, but they just leave it right there. It's not even expurgated. It's simply just not necessary. But you get the impression, certainly, that they're interested. But that's it.
Yeah. And the other thing that's really fascinating is the use of the world of television. Because obviously television had become this big new threat to cinema. And this is a film where, you know, what television is doing to popular culture is both celebrated and mocked. So you have the things like, is it George drawing the glasses on the TV monitor while they're listening to a conversation with Dick Spinetti.
Yes.
And the fact that he's so uptight and coming to you and all that stuff, it just, it captures what was going on in mass media and the Beatles as masters of it, and in a way not trapped by it. I find that intriguing as well.
Yeah, I agree. What a strange TV variety programme they were coming down to London to.
What was the operetta?
What a very strange. I mean, they were on some strange programmes in their time, but this one's got opera in it. I mean, who ever heard of the Beatles and opera in the same space?
Mark, you're going to tell us, what was the German language operetta that the performances
encountered? I'm not going to tell you.
You're not? You don't know that fact?
I'm quite wrong about that. I'm not going to tell you.
Oh,
I want to say La Traviata, but I always do on a Saturday afternoon.
No, well, it's German, but...
Yes.
So I think it's going to be a lot to go through the whole film, but I mean, the first few scenes, we've got the opening scene running down Boston Place. I've got my own theory of why George fell over. Two theories.
Go on, what's your theory?
Well, part Pete Schroeder did is Furore magazine, which is brilliant, and he suggested it might be a drain pipe, which is still there to this day, if you go to Boston Place, around the corner from Marylebone's station. And also, I think it's because George runs a bit bow-legged, because he does that dance as well, where he's sort of dancing like that.
Well,
and I think as he's getting faster and faster, he's starting to go bow-legged.
So, two observations. By weird coincidence, I was there yesterday, because my dad lives around the corner, and I don't think he trips on the drainpipe, for what it's worth.
Really?
But the other thing that I noticed watching it back is George has got one hand in a pocket as he falls, which is why Stuart's right, it's such a bad fall. Like, that wrist, you know, you just keep thinking, he's lucky he didn't break it. And then, as you say, it's a pylon. And I counted, there's about six falls, isn't there, within the first couple of minutes of that film. It's like
the Grand National, isn't it?
Yeah.
Health and safety wasn't...
It's like Beecher's Brook down Boston Place.
St. Mary's Hospital, Paddington, there's an influx of stretchers coming in with young
Can I just quickly butt in on this? First of all, I recently did an event in Ireland with Nothing Is Real guys, one of whom is here today.
Stephen, stand up. Very well.
I don't see him standing, but I know he's here. Yeah, anyway, I finished his podcast as well as I'm finishing yours.
Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, so for that one, I actually slowed down that bit of action because it does happen so fast, and in slow-mo, you can actually see that George trips over Ringo's foot. They're running fast and very, very close down a narrow pavement, and he trips over Ringo's foot. So that's why he goes, and then Ringo goes with him as well. He also hits the deck. And if you do watch it in slow motion, you will see that twice after that, before the end of that scene, George has looked at his hand. He's obviously scratched himself very badly, but he's still grinning and laughing and having a lovely time.
John's in hysterics.
John's in hysterics.
Can you see the continuity on this film is outstanding? When you consider how much of it is shot tightly in train compartments, and there are a lot of shot changes, and yet there's never a hand that's in the wrong place. I thought it was astounding.
Two more things quickly on Boston Place. One, if you've not been there, please do go. It's right by the side of Marylebone Station. And the moment you stand there, you realise you're at the beginning of A Hard Day's Night. Certain things have changed in the background, but essentially that bit of pavement, if you focus on that, you are in A Hard Day's Night. So, and it's 60 years ago, so it's worth visiting. But the other thing is that 4 years later, the Beatles set up Alexis Mardas, Magic Alex, in a laboratory on Boston Place. So they buy a property there 4 years later without, I think, realizing they'd been and filmed there. I think the estate agent found this place. They needed a laboratory for Alex, and they set him up in Boston Place. And Apple, when I first went there in the early 80s, the doorbell still said Apple on it because they used to store their tapes and guitars and things there, amazingly.
Because I think Paul's referring to that in the Hey Jude outtake.
He says, if I was a robber in Boston Place.
Possibly about Magic Alex.
No, I don't think so, but it was just about Boston Place being... It was in their minds because they owned it. They owned a place there. How weird is that, that they owned a place where they'd filmed?
That's amazing. Mm. Can I have got a little list of pop culture references that jump out of this film? Because now that you can get it on... you can just freeze frame it as you watch it. So, Shake is reading Son of Mad and the book. And Mad magazine, and it was such a sort of interesting outlet for your imagination. We didn't have that kind of stuff really here, did we? It was kind of big import. And then when Shake walks, what's his name? Norman Rosington's character walks in. Actually, it is Shake. He walks in with snacks. Do you remember when they first find them on the train? And Is it Diet Pepsi as opposed to regular Pepsi? I was trying to read the label of that bottle, but it's Pepsi, isn't it?
It's Pepsi. I don't think it's Diet.
But also, he's got a box of what look like Mr. Kipling slices. I'm trying to identify them. But I was quite interested in you know, because snacks and the Beatles fascinate me, because, like, when you watch Get Back, all there was tea and toast. You couldn't order a fancy latte or anything. And, you know, it just concentrates your mind, because there wasn't that much interesting tea.
Well, if you cast your mind back to the little cafeteria on British Rail trains in the 60s or 70s, fairly limited.
Well, in this one, there's champagne and trays of sandwiches and...
The funny thing was that they lived on that train for a week more or less, and they had beautiful lunches when everybody has to have, it was all highly unionized, had to have a proper lunch break, and within that they would have white tablecloths and champagne, and it was really quite high living.
Well, I've got one of the cultural references I spotted. You know, in the hotel room when John is reading a magazine on the sofa, do you know what that magazine says on the cover, what the cover feature is? The first scientific survey of one of the greatest pop groups. And that's the cover of the magazine. And it's a photograph of someone else, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Jerry Marsden, I think. I think it was one of those boyfriend, Pete Schroeder's Furore publication has shown us which magazine that was. I think it was one of those boyfriend specials.
Yeah, but would that have been deliberate by Richard Lester? Because no one would have spotted it, and you didn't have freeze frames.
Well, I doubt it, but who knows? Richard Lester, who's still with us, it's the kind of question that would annoy the hell out of him. I don't know, he would say.
The other thing I find really interesting is, you know, the whole sequence in the advertising agency, which, as everyone was saying earlier, is such a brilliant moment of reflecting on how, you know, the man is trying to monetize youth culture. It was yet to really happen. I mean, the swinging 60s moment with Time magazine seems to be the thing that destroys the very scene it's documenting. And Johnny Spaight, who was the person that was originally Richard Lester's idea to write the script, went on to write the script, I think, for Peter Watkins' film Privilege, which is all about advertising people taking over a pop star and turning him into their creature. And it's a very dystopian sort of film in which, you know, a pop group ends up being used for, you know, to prop up a kind of authoritarian government. But I was really interested that all that, in a way, comes out of that one scene in Hard Day's Night. There are so many moments that emerge from this film that spin off into their own genres almost.
It's like anything to do with the Beatles. It's interesting on every level. There's the film, you can just enjoy the film, it's a great film. But the moment you start to look into the whys and wherefores of it, often done on the spur of the moment, but always in the right way, and with motive, not motives, but always with subtext that becomes fascinating.
And so the scene when they start singing for the first time on the train is the first pop video. And I know my friend Ben Milne and I were talking about this, but it is, because you're intercutting them playing instruments with them playing a game of cards as if they're oblivious. And all pop videos, that's the template.
I think the editing on that is particularly brilliant, because, as you know, before they didn't want to do another, okay, let's burst into song. And it's so subtly edited, because they're sort of playing cards, and then you see George kind of moving his head, and then suddenly John's got the harmonica, and they're all playing, and it's so, it sort of weaves in, doesn't it, without...
You noticed something about, you know, they filmed that on a set, and
yes,
the rocking of the carriage. Tell us about that.
Well, that actually, that sequence where they're playing I Should Have Known Better, and playing cards.
Not the Jim Diamond version.
Sorry?
Not the Jim Diamond version.
No. Just that was done at Twickenham Film Studios. And in the very same room where they shot Get Back, Let It Be, 4.5 years later, it's and where they shot Help as well, it's the main number one studio at Twickenham on the lot. And they actually, in the Get Back film, you actually see a train is delivered. I don't want to say a train set, but a mocked-up train that will be a set in the film of Magic Christian is wheeled in while the Beatles are there. It's in Peter Jackson's Get Back. Well, they had a mocked-up train in that studio for A Hard Day's Night, and that's where they did some of the interiors, that one in particular.
But what did you say about the people they had rocking the carriage?
Well, of course, there had to be people rocking it to create the idea of motion. So yes,
and they started rocking it in time to the song. They had to tell them to stop rocking it in time to the singing.
Well, the songs were that catchy.
Yeah. Oh, and I've got to mention, because it's the hair in this film, like the Beatles' hair. And it's really important because I know that there are Doctor Who-related people here too. You know, there was a cover of Doctor Who magazine recently related to that episode with the Beatles, and it had four actors, three of whom in real life from Liverpool, I think, but they just don't look right. And it's not because they literally don't look exactly like the Beatles, it's because they've got obvious wigs on. Whereas you look at A Hard Day's Night, all their hair is different. It's really clean and really fluffy, and it's every cut is completely different. And I could see why it drove adults mad. They couldn't make sense of why the Beatles look this good and why...
They look wonderful in A Hard Day's Night. There are so many brilliant aspects of the film, but one of them is how they look. They look absolutely perfect, don't they?
And they all look different. They're not dressed the same. The photograph they're signing is the old Beatles in the matching jackets. I think it's really important they're putting that behind them. And that's the image that Wilfred Bramble's holding on to. I think it's so subversive about their own image already.
There are many, many clever aspects of this film. One of them is that the word Beatles is not mentioned.
Yes.
I mean, how subtle is that to actually hold back from mentioning the word that was on the lips of everyone in the world, it seemed, at that time. And they don't say it. It's not said. You see it on a drum kit, only see it on Ringo's drum kit. And at the very, very end, when they reuse the BEA helicopter, adding a T-L-E-S after it. But it's never said at any time. And that subtlety is very important because in Richard Lester, the Beatles found, they just found the perfect director. And what I was going to say is that the Beatles had this incredible knack of always drawing the best people to them. And they had the best manager they could ever have had in Brian Epstein. They had the best record producer they could ever have had in George Martin. And in Richard Lester, they had the best film director they could have ever had.
I think Alan Owen... genius.
Alan Owen wrote a brilliant script. Yes, the whole package of A Hard Day's Night is as close to artistic perfection as I think it's ever possible to get.
Yeah, you know, like another line. You know, Stuart was talking about some of those lines that come out of nowhere, and he'd cost you a fortune in breach of promise cases.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember memorising these lines, not quite understanding them, but they had a poetic quality.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. And they're not the kind of lines that they would naturally say necessarily, and yet they delivered them so well.
Yeah, and the lines, you could deliver them in little bits, because they were cramming their scripts, weren't they, on the train, rather than trying to learn them in advance. And so they deliver in bursts, because that's what's needed, and that's why it comes across so well.
So yeah, so Richard Lester edited it and John Jimson, the editor, edited to match that kind of staccato style, where it's one line, one line, one line, and they make a virtue of it. Instead of it being in any way inhibiting to the progress, it actually adds to the speed of it. It's just such a fast-cut film. Everything about the film is fast, including the editing.
Yeah. You know that press conference scene when they get to the sort of before the rehearsals, and what really struck me, and it struck me again and again watching newsreel of the Beatles, is the stupid, inane questions that journalists at the time used to ask them to fill their papers. What are your hobbies? How would you like your girlfriend to dress? You know, stuff that just no one really is interested in. And it was as if they didn't know what to ask the Beatles.
None of the journalists, they were all older. Journalists, by definition, were older than they were, and they hadn't grown up with rock music. They didn't know anything about people who played guitars. Everybody in this space today has grown up with guitar music as part of our warp and weft. It's there from infancy. But none of the journalists had, and so they didn't think to ask them about their music. Because it wasn't of interest to them. They didn't necessarily even like the music. They liked them as personalities. And that's why they would ask personality type questions. And obviously they were really irritating questions. And the film makes a virtue of that by showing you how stupid they were. But I love it when it's a question about hobbies, and John takes the pen and paper and writes something and shows it to the woman, who reels back in shock, and we never find out what he wrote.
You know, but you looked at the pen strokes and you thought, it's not enough pen strokes to have written S-E-X, is it?
I haven't looked that
closely.
Yeah,
no, if you watch it, he writes two letters.
Right.
Yeah, I think.
Two letters, well, we'll think about that one.
Yeah, think about that
one. I think some of the best lines are when they're in the hotel room talking about Ringo's nose. There's some incredible lines such as, do I snore, John? Yeah, you're a real window rattler, son.
A real window rattler, son.
I mean, we've sort of moaned about Paul, but he gets the best line. With a trombone hooter like yours, it'd be unnatural if you don't. And I know, Stuart, you're not keen on Will's grandfather, but now, Paulie, don't mock the afflicted. He can't help having a hideous great hooter. And the poor little head trembling under the weight of it. Just worth it just for that. Sorry, carry on.
It was good Irish accents. Well, the other thing is, without saying it explicitly, it's the film that makes it clear that the Irish heritage that three of them had.
Yes, yes.
At a time when, you know, the Irish were discriminated against very much.
Yeah, I mean, it came up in the first half how Stuart said that Paul's grandfather, Wilfred Bramble's character, suddenly goes into this IRA. That's extraordinary. This is a film with a youth certificate, and it's got IRA anthems in it. Nation once again, all of that stuff. I mean, where'd that come from? It didn't need to be there, but I'm very glad that it is.
Again, we were saying about earlier how they are deliberately filmed in cramped. I mean, they're in the cage at the beginning, literally. It's
yeah, very close.
So it's a lot of hotel rooms, and then you get the nightclub scene, which is, again, very similar to Maisel's Brothers.
I love watching. I know some people didn't like character of Norm, but I love when he comes in and tries to round them up, and you just see him mouthing home at them. And there was something, again, I think as a child watching this film, while we bonded with it, because it was them being rounded up by a parent and sent back to do their homework.
Yeah, there's a vague reference to The Office at one point. There's no notion the Beatles have a manager because we don't see him, nor is he referred to, but there is a mention of The Office says. But obviously he's an emissary for The Office. He's the Neil character. And I do think he's necessary because somebody has to round them up. There needs to be someone there who's kind of, that they can rebel against. And when he says, don't leave this room, they leave this room. Well, you need to have that action-reaction, if you like.
Is it true, I was reading in, possibly in your book of A Hard Day's Night Rock, that Ringo was a really good dancer and did pick up his girlfriends in nightclubs? Like when he was younger, like he'd always been a really good dancer.
Ringo had always been a really good dancer, yeah.
Because he's prone for laughs in this film. Is it one of the writers of In 8½ Hot Mum that he's dancing?
In the nightclub scene, which was actually filmed in the real club, Les Ambassadeurs, which is still there, off Park Lane. Jeremy Lloyd
is
the tall beanpole public schoolboy.
And they start leaping.
And he was a wacky guy. He used to dance like that, like he was on a pogo stick. Early pogoing, in fact. And Ringo responds to that by doing something of a leap, a very small one himself. But that was Jeremy Lloyd, who went on to write "Hello, Hello."
Yeah.
And "Are You Being Served?" Yeah.
Isn't Charlotte Rampling in that scene as well, actually?
Allegedly. I don't know if she really was, but she was his girlfriend at the time, so maybe.
Why do we not see John and Paul dancing in that scene?
John and Paul couldn't really dance very well.
That's shocking.
And it was quite appropriate that they were sitting down. And Paul intimates that he's scored, doesn't he? He's picked up a girl in the club. So as I say, the film was not... You would not get from that film that they weren't interested in women, but they were very clever in making sure they didn't have any attachments because they knew that girls were going to form a significant part of the global audience and that they might not be happy if they saw someone who was really with Paul in the film. They just made clear that, you know, that he had no time for it, but he was interested.
And that's the sequence where you're seeing the swinging London that other films try to emulate. Whereas when you get to the concert sequences, the audience are all children.
Yeah, they're very, very young. Very young audience, yeah. Swinging London, I guess it's on the cusp of it, but what I like about the film, is one of a million things I like about the film, is the location shooting was on drab streets of London. It's not colourful, it's not Carnaby Street, it's about a mile from here. A lot of that film was shot in Notting Hill, about a mile from where we're sitting today. And the Notting Hill riots have been in 1958, this is only 6 years on. There's a lot of wartime destruction still. That scene with, what's his name, John Bluthal, when he's the car thief,
yes.
And they're running back and forth. It's a brilliant addition by Richard Lester just to put a bit of slapstick in the film. And John Bluthal played it so well. There's a bombed out church behind them.
Yes.
Because London, you know, we were still recovering at that time. The war hadn't been 20 years yet.
You know, the slapstick, there's a lot of very Marx Brothers jokes, which are kind of deliberately so. I read that Groucho Marx didn't like the Beatles. He'd said as much to Lester.
Groucho was a wisecracker, and he always had to have a quip. And people, journalists asked him questions so that he would have quips because they expected it. And he had an acidic quip about the Beatles. But he was just showing how unhip he was, much as I love Groucho Marx. I mean, adults didn't get the Beatles, particularly American adults, at that time. It took a while. And at that time, it was fashionable to say something dismissive, and he did.
That's interesting.
There's that, digressing hugely, there's that scene of Dean Martin introducing the Stones in America. And at the end, he just goes, "Weren't they great?"
It's shocking to see just how these people outed themselves as being unhip while thinking they were being hip.
But that's another thing which this film captures so well, is what was entertainment and what was promoted as being valuable. So that operetta that Victor Spinetti is rehearsing, if you look at what was kept by the BBC and what they wiped Top of the Pops, they wiped all the entertainment that we crave now, but they kept opera and ballet and interviews with kind of serious philosophers and thinkers, because that was the stuff they thought would be valued. And it's so interesting what popular culture has revealed to us about what we really care about.
It was held to be disposable, and it wasn't just the BBC, it was all the ITV companies and American television as well. It was a universal thought that this was here today and gone tomorrow. And in fact, it's here 60 years on.
I was going to mention the concert. You know, the concert at the end, because watching it again yesterday, I was struck by how raw and exciting it feels. I mean, they've really captured the concert. This is Alexander Walker's book on Hollywood, England, and he interviewed the cinematographer on it, who said that for the sequence of the concert, they used no fewer than 6 cameras simultaneously with 10x1 zoom lenses. And since there was not much work then, I think you mentioned the film industry, we were able to engage crack operators on every one of them and give them orders to shoot and shoot and shoot. And that's why it looks so fabulous.
The filming of A Hard Day's Night is brilliant. The Richard Lester knew all the right people. Gil Taylor was the cinematographer. And ultimately, he went on to do Star Wars.
Yes.
He was extremely good. And there isn't a thing about A Hard Day's Night cinematographically that is poor. It is absolutely spot on the whole time. It's beautifully shot.
Didn't Gilbert Taylor say that he felt guilty that what they'd done by shooting the concert the way they had and putting it on film fed the hysteria? That's what comes up in an interview.
I think he thought that, but one of the things in the film is we've got music elements during the film, like on the train and so on, but it has to lead to something, and the whole way the premise is it's leading to a TV show, so they couldn't not show the TV show. All that audience would have been sitting there through the operetta as well. I wonder what they thought of that.
I never quite worked out what was this program going to look like. The other observation I have, and this is a slightly weird thing, but there is this weird Venn diagram in my head, which is the Beatles' Hard Day's Night and the Beatles in general and Cliff Richard. And there is this weird overlap moment, which is, if you think about the young ones, which is, I think, 61.
Yes.
I know it's a let's put the show on right here. That's literally the plot. But the audience is exactly the same. They're all about 10 to 12 years old. Yeah. There's a lot of boys as well as girls there. And they're all screaming enthusiastically.
Yes.
And they're watching stuff that is playing with pastiches of variety and old-style entertainment. All of that old culture is referenced in this film. And even the use of an old theatre, because the Scala Theatre... wasn't in use, really.
No,
But you just have that sense of a new media going into an old building, whereas the young ones purports to be youth culture looking forward is actually from the past. And I'm just fascinated, about 3 years apart, something so different happens.
Yeah, well, talking of 3 years apart, it's forgotten now, but A Hard Day's Night was released at the same time as a Cliff film and an Elvis film. The West End of London had 3 films at the same time. They had Elvis in Kissing Cousins, which is a really bad film. They had Cliff in Wonderful Life, which
that was 4 days earlier.
Okay, not It's a Wonderful Life, just Wonderful Life.
Melvin Hayes is very conscious that's not a great film.
Yeah. not a good film. And then A Hard Day's Night, which just completely is... A Hard Day's Night is today and tomorrow, and both those other films were yesterday.
Yeah.
And the fact that they were on at the same time provides the perfect contrast.
Yes.
I was talking to Melvin Hayes yesterday, because I'm interviewing him on Front Row next week, and he was saying that when they made Summer Holiday, which came out in 63, which is, in its own way, it's supposed to be future-looking. It's, you know, Europe going on holiday. There's four of them. They dyed Melvin Hayes' hair blonde, and the American producers explained to him that in America, the sidekick to the hero would always be blonde, like Van Johnson, and therefore you should be blonde. And that literal transplantation or attempted transplantation of American model is why that film does not hold up in the same way, although I have to say I have a lot of affection for Summer Holiday. But The Hard Day's Night is a new template. It's everything is it's unique. This is, again, which comes back to what you say, Mark.
Now, you're talking there about American production company. There was one company in the British film industry in those days that was unique, and that was United Artists, because they would provide the money, but they wouldn't interfere. They would often say, just invite us to the cutting room or invite us to see a preview when it's done. But they would leave the creative people, in this case Richard Lester, to get on with it. They would trust him to do it. They wouldn't need to see the dailies even. So though they provided the money, they didn't butt in any way whatsoever. And Richard Lester was given a free hand. And that, it was unique. And if it hadn't been United Artists, it wouldn't have happened. So United Artists really do deserve a lot of credit. And they made a lot of films in Britain at that time which were successful. Tom Jones the previous year, A Taste of Honey, these were United Artists films. Very important that one considers United Artists, as its name suggests, was an artist-friendly film production company in a way that 20th Century Fox and Paramount were not. They were the interfering kind, and United Artists were not.
And when you think of all the attempted pop group films that were to follow, why do none of them land? It's because none of them have the Beatles at their heart and that magic combination of ingredients around them. So I was thinking of John Borman's Catch Us If You Can, which is, it's John Borman, you know, he goes on to make all these great films. And it's got Bath and it's got, what's her name? Mildred, from George and Mildred in it. I mean,
Youth of Joyce.
Yeah, Youth of Joyce. And yet the film doesn't, it's because they haven't got the charisma.
Nice.
You know, the setting, the costumes, everything are a distraction around the fact that there's something missing at the heart of it. And this is the opposite.
The Beatles film is special in as I keep saying, in so many ways. One of them is the fact that it's four of them. The Cliff film have been about, Cliff films are about Cliff. The Shadows might be there, but they don't really have anything to do. And similarly, the Elvis film is about Elvis. But the Beatles film, the whole scope of it was, we've got to give these four people kind of equal space and show them as a group. They've got individual personalities, but they are this tight-knit group. So that notion is unique in the first instance, because there hadn't been a group before. Not really. There hadn't been one. That is what made the Beatles so different. It's just like, there are four of them. Oh, my God. Well, I like that one. Well, I like that one. Well, I like that one. With Cliff, you just like Cliff.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm not just dissing Cliff here, but it wasn't his fault. It was only one of him.
Yeah.
But... The virtue of the Beatles being a foursome was unique and new, and they put it together brilliantly. But if you're really looking for contrast, soon after this was completed, in fact they overlapped, another of Brian Epstein's groups, Gerry and the Pacemakers, second name check for Gerry today, made a film called Ferry Across the Mersey. And you would think that would have picked up on all the clues to the new direction that A Hard Day's Night would have provided, but it doesn't. It's a terrible film, because they just don't have the personality to carry it. The writing wasn't so good, the direction wasn't so good, photography wasn't so good, the editing wasn't so good. Everything about A Hard Day's Night that makes it brilliant was lacking in Ferry Across the Mersey.
One of my favourite moments, one of them, more of which later, is the scene where Ringo, very hungover, he's walking along, speaking to the little mudlark boy who is here today, David Jensen. Should be your mic over there.
Thank you very much for your long and rapturous applause. It's going to sound really good on the podcast.
How old are you?
It's not polite to ask a gentleman his age. You should know that.
I mean, just working it out, you were a child in A Hard Day's Night. You were about, how old were you then, about 10?
I was actually, no. I think that's the part of it. I was actually 14 when we filmed that, but I think I look about, 10. And I know when we went for, I went for the audition for the job, there were loads and loads and loads of kids there, but they were all little. And they were all about 9 or 10, because I think in the original draft, it probably said that he was supposed to be about 8 or 9, that boy. And we changed it, obviously, because I was just a little bit older than that. But I think, I don't know. How old did I look when we actually filmed that?
12.
Yeah. 10, 12.
Yeah.
10, 12. But yeah, I was actually 14. I just turned 14.
Can I say, I found your sequence so moving. I felt almost at the point of tears every time I watched that film. And I was only about 9 or 10 when I first watched it.
Amazing. I think it was a privilege. Now, I have to say it's a privilege to have been in it. But that whole day, we spent the whole day down the towpath. And it was such an easy, nice day. And it's all been condensed into, 40 seconds? But I think it's been cut together incredibly well. I think the arrangement was beautiful, which helped with the editing, because it was taken at a much slower pace than everything else in the film, I think. And we just had a lot of fun. And I had no idea Ringo was hungover at all.
We know it now. You said it in your introduction there, but it's not evident. And we only know it because he said that he was wrecked. More or less straight from the Ad Lib Club, I think.
I think the very first shot of it you see after I've knocked him over with the tie, when he's bent down over, if you look then, he looks a bit of a wreck. he does, doesn't he? I mean, he's got bags under his eyes and everything else. And all that miraculously disappears as the sequence goes through, because we were there for the whole day.
Because there are a few takes of that tire, weren't there, that they couldn't quite get?
Oh, there were loads. I mean, I've seen that written down in a cartoon strip somewhere. And yes, they were. It was sort of strange in a some sort of way, because when I first got there, the other three boys were already there, and they were actually sort of going through the scene with Dick Lester, and then Ringo arrived, and they were going through it, and I was sitting there, standing there, thinking, perhaps I'm not doing this, perhaps they're all doing it, and I didn't know whether there was going to be any or not, and then everything got geared up, and we were ready to start filming, and it was right, here we go, right, roll the tire in, the boy runs in, off we go. An hour, I think that took, and every single member of the crew had a go with the tire, and nobody could get it to go anywhere near Ringo. Now, if he was doing that with a hangover, just walking away from the camera, waiting for this tire to come and hit him, and it just kept sailing past him, or stopping, and it did go on forever and ever. And then eventually they said, give it to David. And I rolled it. And it wasn't the first time, but I think it was the second time it happened. And then, of course, it was suddenly, oh my God, we've got to get on with the scene now.
Yeah.
And so running in, and we got as far as grabbing hold of the tire, and then we sort of stopped then.
Did they give you a whole backstory for your character? Like, was social services involved in the family?
No. No, it wouldn't be allowed now, would it? Sort of go, man goes along and accosts this young boy on a towpath.
I was thinking more river. That you were,
wouldn't
you were a deserter. It was more that.
Yeah. No, there was none of that. Absolutely no in-depth analysis of that little scene at all. And I didn't think about it, and I don't think Ringo was probably capable of thinking about it now. Because, I wouldn't have known what a hangover was when I was 14. Now I do. I wouldn't. That's the last thing I would want to be doing, faced with, sort of going down and having to do that whole scene on his own, without his pals around him, to try and do all of that. I mean, from all accounts, what I've heard now is that he actually hadn't even been to bed. I think he was dragged, taken out of the nightclub. Is that true?
The ad lib closed about 4 o'clock, so he probably had got a bit of sleep, because you were on set 8 a.m., 9 a.m. It would have been something like that.
He certainly wasn't up all night learning his lines, was he?
No.
But there's quite a sad story in later on in the film where you weren't in it.
Oh, what the second? There's when they eventually went to the Scala and the three boys were trying to get Wilfred Bramble into the theatre. I was supposed to be in that scene, but I was actually rehearsing for something else for the BBC, so I couldn't get there for the first thing in the morning. I got there just before lunch, and Dick Lester was there with Wilfred, and they shared the lines out. Between the other three boys. No, which is great. I thought it was a great smashing thing to do because it gave them an opportunity to do something in the film as well. And there was always what they wanted to do when we were in the Scala was actually find other opportunities for the four boys to be able to get involved in the chaos that was going
on.
It's
like a little parallel,
theater.
Like mini Fab Four.
That's been said. That has been said that they... That what it was about. And if you sat down and analysed the scene now, exactly what was being said throughout that little bit about the other, explaining who the other guys were, what was it? So,
Ding Dong, one was Ding Dong.
Ding Dong, yeah, Ginger.
Yeah, I think Adam S. Leslie, who's here somewhere, made a really good point on this, and I'd never considered it before, but the parallels. So you've got, Charlie, we learn your name from the other, come on Charlie!
Yeah, at the end.
Yeah, it's actually got a name. But yeah, Charlie, like Ringo, is a deserter. He's deserted. And then you've got, so see if you can guess which beetle they might be. So his friend Ginger is described as, Ginger's mad! He says things all the time. John? Eddie's good at spitting and punching. George, which leaves Ding Dong Bell. He's a big head and he fancies himself. Could be Victor Spinetti, I don't know.
And at the end of it, having gone through that whole sequence and he's saying what it's like, and you said they were, and he says, yeah, they're all right, you said, because they're all in the gang.
Yes.
And I think that's, if you look at it, you could have said it was a perfectly written scene to explain to Ringo that actually it's not so bad being in a group of guys looking after themselves. So I think, but nothing like that was ever talked about at all when we actually started filming that.
Could have done with you in Let It Be.
What was it like when you saw the finished film? Did you go to the premiere?
No. Oh. I was never invited. That was the... Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, and I think and everybody says, surely you must remember the first time you saw the film. And I honestly cannot. And I think... I know that there was actually a newspaper cutting about me being in the film and saying I was awaiting the premiere. But no, I never got the invite at all. And I often wonder whether it actually went to my drama school. And the principal got hold of it. I mean, it's before eBay, so you couldn't have flogged them online. Yes. So, or whether they actually went, and I never did. Mm. And they could have looked at it. I was actually, I think, when the premiere was happening, I got a feeling that I was actually in the studio at the BBC doing a thing called Kipling, a series they were doing, and I was doing an episode of that. So I probably couldn't have gone anyway. But... They should have invited me.
I just want to butt in and say there's a nice parallel there anyway in that scene because you're playing by the river, right? It's the Thames, but it's just a river. You don't know where it is. And Ringo, this is 1964. Ringo left school in 1956, but he had missed so much of his education at secondary modern school that he often used to bunk off, or sag off as they called it in Liverpool, and play down on the cast iron shore, the Cazzy, in Egberth in Liverpool, which is where Alan Owen came from. So in essence, Ringo is acting. He would have been a boy like you had that been filmed a few years earlier. it was actually a scene that was realistic to him because he used to play down at the river when he was bunking off school, as you were.
And do you think they would have talked about that to Alan? Would Ringo have talked to them?
It's possible that he had, especially since Alan Owen came from Egberth in Liverpool, south end of Liverpool. Ringo might have said, you know, I used to play on the shore down there. And that's why Cast Iron Shore is mentioned in Glass Onion, because it was a real place, and it was a place that they knew.
There's a lovely scene when Ringo is lying against the sort of the brickwork, you know, when the tide's gone out, lying there with his hands behind his back, you know, thinking, and we don't know quite what, and you're playing in the background with your
climbing
friend.
Up the wall. Yeah,
yeah, it's just so moving.
All of that sequence that was, you know, playing, throwing the stones and everything else in the river and all of that was all shot at the end once we'd finished doing the main body of the scene. And obviously they had to do it when the tide was out as well. So all of that was actually done at the very, very end of the filming day. And it was very, very shortly after that that the crowds that had gathered, again, of all the children, and how on earth they all got to know exactly where we were filming, I don't know. Because at the start of the day, they barricaded, there's a towpath that goes up to the road at Kew Bridge, and they barricaded the whole of that off so that we could have a good day's filming there. And throughout the day, people slowly got to know that we were doing Hard Day's Night, and Ringo was there. And they slowly but surely kept pushing against that barrier until eventually they knocked the whole barrier down, and they all came flooding down the towpath. At which point, end of day's filming. I think they were sort of used to that from what I can gather, because this was quite, Mark can tell us, but it was probably fairly late on in the shooting of the film.
April the 9th.
Somehow they got to know.
What time?
Sorry, I didn't know that. I've been trying for months and months now to find out exactly what day it was. I didn't know. Thanks. No, I will put that in my diary now so I know where I was.
You've just missed the anniversary of it. You could have gone down to Kew Towpath again. When I went to Kew Towpath to find the location in the late 1980s, when these things weren't researchable easily and they had to be found, I was there with my great friend Pete Schroeders, and he said to me, "Do you realise what you're whistling?" And I hadn't. And I was whistling Ringo's theme, This Boy, the George Martin arrangement of it, which is so perfect for that scene.
Yeah.
And I hadn't even realised it, but when you go to the place, the theme music comes with it. It's kind of in the air there. Yeah.
What I was going to say was, at the end of that day, was I think my glimpse into the reality of what their life was like, because once everybody came flooding down, the only priority then was to get Ringo and myself into the car, away from it all. And a car literally just pulled up. Ringo was thrown in, I went in, and I was sitting in the back with Ringo, and the hundreds and hundreds of kids came down, and they didn't care. They just clamoured all over the car and was banging on the roof and everything else, and we were obviously trying to leave at that point.
Are you sure it wasn't for you?
No. What you mean, they'd heard about the fact that I was there because I was such a big superstar at the time? Yes. No, not at all. But it was frightening, actually. It was quite frightening. And because they were literally hammering, climbing all over the car, hammering on it, and while the driver was very carefully trying to drive us up the path to get ourselves back to the studios. And that was the time I thought, God, that's what their life is like. Yes. They're so used to that. And Ringo literally was just sitting there going, yeah, well, you know, that's the day. And I thought, my God, this is unbelievable. This is their life. This is what they have to put up with day after day after day, working, you know, because they couldn't go anywhere. They couldn't do anything. It's fame at an extraordinary level, that I thought.
But you got to see both sides, didn't you, later on?
Yes, because we went back to do... Oh, actually, Mark, you can tell me this, because there was a gap between having done the towpath and then going to do the sequence in the Scala, and that when I was working. But I don't know what day that was. It was a little bit later.
Well, actually, the Scala filming was before the towpath.
Yeah, but we went back.
Does that make sense?
No, not at all. Not for me, because we shot that first bit, and then we went a little while later. We went to do the second bit, which was outside where we didn't that I wasn't in, ended up being much involved in. But we went in and sat down to, in the Scarlet, and they were having a press conference. And the four boys were sitting up there talking about it and everything else. And that's the first time that I actually got to say hello to all four of them. Or rather, they came and said hello to me, because at the end of the press conference, they said, right, that's that. And they all came out, and they all came up to me and said, we've just been watching the rushes of that scene. And they say, and it's absolutely fantastic. And they all come down, shook my hand off, they went. And then the press all come to ask me why they all did that and what was happening, you know, while everybody else was taking everything that was on the table where they were having the conference. Everything, the cigarette butts out the ashtrays themselves, anything that the Beatles had touched was being cleared by the clean everybody, because they just wanted anything and everything to do with the Beatles.
Yeah. Can I just say that we've been talking about A Hard Day's Night this whole time, but at the time when this was shot, they didn't have a title for the film. It was untitled the whole way through. And there was an assumption on the part of the media, the press, that it would be called Beatlemania, but it was never going to be called Beatlemania, because the Beatles didn't like that word. They never used it themselves. They didn't want to have that as their title. It was a media word. So it was lacking a title the whole time. And because the film would need a title song, it lacked the title song as well. And the genesis of that, and we don't exactly know when Ringo said this, but they came out of a long day of work. And he looked around, having been in a studio all day long, thinking it was still daytime and it was night. And he said, it's been a hard day, it's night, like that. And John liked it so much that he put it into one of his pieces of writing. Called St. Michael, which is in his book In His Own Right, which came out during the shooting of the film in March. And John got on very well with the producer, Walter Shenson, and they had lunch one day, and Walter said, we're still looking for a title, which John knew. And John said, there's this line in my piece I've written called A Hard Day's Night that Ringo said it, and I've used it. And Walter Shenson said, that could work. That could work, but you'll have to write a song called A Hard Day's Night. You've got to go away and come up with a song that will be the opening song in the film. And it's principally a John Lennon song. In fact, most of the songs on A Hard Day's Night are. And he went home and wrote A Hard Day's Night, which is absolutely incredible. And wrote in the studio, he was still living in West Kensington, again, very near here. At that time, and rode to the studio in a taxi with Maureen Cleave, the journalist from the Evening Standard. And he'd written the lyric on the back of a birthday card to his boy Julian, who just had his first birthday, and received a huge number of cards because he was a Beatles son. And John had taken the back of one of these cards and scribbled the lyric of A Hard Day's Night on it, and they recorded it in one session. And the rest is history. But the speed of all of this is breathtaking. And A Hard Day's Night has a title. We just say it, and we've been saying it all day long, all afternoon. It doesn't really mean anything. It's perplexing, because what actually is it saying?
Yes.
And the fact that it doesn't quite make sense, and yet it does, is perfect for this film, because it's a little bit quixotic. It's you think you know what it means, but you don't quite. And that sums up the whole film. Every single thing these guys did at that time was gold. Absolute gold, and A Hard Day's Night is gold bars through and through.
But it also sounds a little bit like it could be a British social realism title, doesn't it?
Yes.
It sounds a bit like a drama.
I can imagine United Artists, who were this brilliant company, as I said, but in America, where they were a little less savvy, I think, in terms of what was going on here, would have gone, it's called what? You know, and Richard Lester did say they had a screening at which it was murmured that the film might need to be revoiced for the American audience.
Yes.
And as funny as that sounds, and as off the agenda as that definitely was, I have spoken to Americans who did see the film in the 60s and really didn't understand it. I think it is much more understandable to a British audience than it is to Americans. Right. But the film went around the world. I recently did that Nothing Is Real event in Dublin, Dunleary, and I showed some of the dubbed versions of A Hard Day's Night. It was dubbed in French, Japanese, and German. And to see these other voices coming out, in fact, you must be dubbed as well in the film.
Probably.
Yeah, I should send you the clips of you in speaking in other languages.
Yeah, that'd be good. Languages I never knew I could even say.
Exactly.
Can I ask about whether you would... Was there any post-syncing at all? Because your scenes are captured on the towpath.
Yeah, no, there were, nothing was done afterwards, and I think it's a credit. It shows you how good the editing and everything was, both visually and sound-wise, because it was shot on a single camera, and we only had, and there was just one sound recordist with his assistants there.
You've got a photograph, haven't you, of like the sound cable coming out of the tyre?
I've got a photograph. My daughter Kira's got it down in front of me. And because I was given these 10x8s at the end of the... when the filming was completed. And you can all actually... I mean, come down and have a look, please. But not right now, obviously. But there's... My daughter said, "Daddy, what is that that's coming out of the bottom of your trousers?" Steady now. And what it is, it's the microphone. It's like this. It's like the leads we've got here. And so that went into a little bayonet, which went up my jumper. And if you look very, very closely next time you have a little look at the film, you'll see there's a tiny little bulge just around my chest bone there, which was the microphone, because this is before radio mics or anything like that. And that lead went all the way down here, down my trousers, came out the bottom, and went along and was plugged into the tape recorder. And so while we're walking along, the camera was on a dolly on the track, following us down there. And in between that was the sound recordist trying to gather up the excess lead that we had walking across and giving it to the man behind him, who was standing there with the boom. Yeah, so he had a whole loop of wires around one arm, the boom up here at the other end. And it was all being recorded there. And we used to do that. They did it when I had to record my lines. They did it again to record Ringo's lines. I've got another photograph which shows us when we were actually just going through the scene together. And you know that's what that is, because there's no microphone coming out of the bottom of our trousers. Please, at the end of this, come down and I'll show you. So it was all very technical. So we did it quite a few times. So we had to do one for the master shot for all and for three, both of us. And then again for my dialogue, and again for Ringo's dialogue. So they had plenty of stuff actually to go through with all of it. And I think it changed quite a bit as we went on, as Ringo certainly got more and more relaxed throughout the day. And it was all decided when we were going through, just talking about it at the end, and we were looking at, Ringo was just playing around with the camera, I was looking at that, and Dick Lester, and he just sort of said, "There's the sequence, just..." So my interest was more about the camera rather than him, which is a lovely thing to be able to do. And it took a lot of pressure off of Ringo, I think.
Well, the nice thing is, you as the boy, whatever age you were depicting, you don't know who he is, do you?
No.
You don't
know
he's a famous man.
That's the whole point of it, yeah. The fact that he's got anonymity now. And he can be who he wants to be.
Yes.
And then gets told that actually it's not a bad thing being part of a band.
Perfect. I think I've just realised my watch has stopped and we've overrun. So apologies for that. Very quickly, my favourite scene is the Anna Quayle scene. One of my favourites. And my esteemed colleague and dear friend Samira has agreed we're going to reenact that scene.
We signed for our equity cards this morning, didn't we?
Now, there's a bit of a problem, and I need your help here, because I can't do a Liverpudlian accent, because it veers into very bad Yorkshire. So the only other impression I can do is Mick Jagger. So if you want me to do the voice in a bad Yorkshire, shout.
Yay!
If you want me to do it in Mick Jagger, shout.
Yay!
Shall we?
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, wait a minute. Don't tell me.
No, I'm not.
Oh, you are.
I'm not.
Oh, you are. I know you are.
I'm not, no.
You look just like him.
Tom. The first time I've ever said that, ever.
Yes, you do. Look.
No, my eyes are lighter.
All right, Noddy. My nose.
Oh, yes, yes. Your nose is very...
Is it?
I would have said so.
Well, you know him better, though.
I do not. He's only a casual acquaintance.
That's what you say.
What have you heard?
It's all over the place.
Anyway, is it really?
But I wouldn't have it. I stuck up for you.
I knew I could rely on you.
Thanks.
You don't look like him at all.
I've got a finish line.
She knows more of him than I do.
Well, I'm so sorry for overrunning. Chris,
can I ask now, with modern technology, are you now going to take that away and dub it onto the original film so that John Lennon is actually going to be with that accent?
And in French.
Brilliant. Send us the tapes.
Can I make one suggestion? I know you've said this is the farewell Eggpod Live, but I know it's a huge amount of work, but isn't next year the 60th anniversary of Help? And I think there would be interest, would there? Even if it was once a year, trying to do an Eggpod Live, what do you reckon? Let's put the show on right here, folks!
No pressure.
We're going to get David Martin along to tell us how it's rubbish.
So, can we have a huge a round of applause for our amazing guests, Samira Ahmed, Mark Lewison, and David Jensen.
Yeah, just... I'd like to say on behalf of us all that you've passed the audition.
Thank you very much. I think, very briefly, I know if it was... Who cares? They lose, Clinton told us, 3-1. Just thank you to everybody. It started from nothing, and now that we're all here together, I think we've been all... For years, there are all of us tribes hidden away listening to the Beatles. And you probably had a mate, one or two mates, that you could talk about it. But it's given a lot of opportunity for lots of Beatles fans to engage with other fans who want to hear about as much stuff at that level. So, and here we all are. We were all here all along, hidden away and around the world.
Thanks to you, Chris.
And, thanks to the Beatles.
You may leave the park through the gates at Ilchester Place, Duchess of Bedford, or the Abbot's Green Lane.
What about the